clarification that I'd like to make. I think the briefs addressed most of the issues, but there are a few factual matters that were not addressed that I wanted to stress, and those are, first, beginning with the legal point that Mr. Halsey's failure to register in this case within 5 days of his birthday did not undermine the purpose of the sex offender registration policy. The respondent argues that Mr. Halsey's recidivism shows that he's unwilling to comply with parole conditions and that he's a risk to society. And I would say that factually that's not correct. There's an abundance of facts that actually haven't been cited previously that I want to cite now that show a pattern on Mr. Halsey's part of complying with the registration requirement.
And there's an abundance of evidence that the trial court went through to show that your client had a miserable history of recidivism. He violated parole routinely over a course of more than 20 years. In fact, recently the police here discovered that he had failed to register was because there was another complaint filed by a woman where he had been mowing her lawn that was peeking in her windows.
That is correct, Your Honor. I would distinguish the type of recidivism, though. The district judge looked at this and found that his recidivism consisted mainly of parole violations, and she pointed the only two she could find were for him being under influence of a controlled substance. There was no violence, there was no felony recidivism, and that's talked about in the case law.
What about the fact that your client was discharged from parole for reaching the statutory maximum amount of time that he could be incarcerated, and therefore, even though he didn't really feel like he was ready to go, they discharged him because they had to? What does that lead? Where does that fact take us? I mean, I sat on the district court, and I looked at this particular situation. He violates his parole. He doesn't really get discharged from parole because he does a good job. He has to go right to the end, and they discharge him because they run out of time. He does register, but he doesn't register often. I mean, he registers sometimes he doesn't. And he's got pretty heavy, violent crimes that he has in his record. And then the ultimate part of that is reading all of that and going through it, then I have to look at that through the glasses of EDPA.
I would say that Mr. Holden has documented in the record that he had a long history of drug and alcohol problems, and I'm not sure if he's getting treatment for that, but I think a lot of his parole violations and recidivism are related to that and his mental health problems. In 2009, he went to the police station in Roosevelt and gave a new address there, showing that he was intending to comply with the registration requirement. And when he was later contacted by the police officer regarding a complaint for him bothering a woman, he told them where he was living. He gave them the correct registered address. So he was not. There's no evidence that he was trying to hide from surveillance or evade the police or anything.
He told them that he hadn't registered. He knew he hadn't registered, and he was waiting for them to send him a reminder.
And that's what he said. I agree. That's what he said.
And he didn't do anything for 2 weeks.
The trial court took into account the drug history and alcohol abuse. He says the fact that he is unemployed, has a history of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, I think his chances and prospects of rehabilitation are dim. So what's wrong? What makes that an unreasonable finding of fact by the state court?
Well, for one thing, the state court didn't address the issue that I'm trying to focus on here regarding the violation of the registration requirement to register within 5 days of your birthday and the separate requirement to register after a change of address. And that's a huge distinction based on both state and federal case law, and that was just glossed over by the sentencing judge. He made really no recognition of that factor, and he focused almost entirely on Mr. Harmony and Gonzalez do help in this case.
But you just told me that you understood that those records were quite different. And since the California Supreme Court has told us we take into account the record, and those records were very different from this case. Your guy has a long history of parole violations and just an inability to follow any rules, whether it's due to alcohol or drug. He isn't following the rules.
But he is. The record shows that he was trying to comply when he went to the police station in 2005 and 2006 and gave him and registered in 2009.
He didn't register in 2007.
He didn't. The record.
Not the courthouse in 2008.
I think he was back in jail for a parole violation of some sort, but he was making an effort to comply. He wasn't trying to obey.
But not complying with the requisites in terms of his release from prison for other offenses. That's why he was sent back to prison repeatedly.
Well, as far as I can tell, he was violating parole for some reason. The district court said two were for control, being under the influence of controlled substance. So that's different from committing armed robberies, burglaries, other serious felonies. He has a drug and alcohol problem that's documented in the record, and that's his major problem. Yeah. I don't know enough of the facts to explain, but he does have a drug and alcohol problem, and he's been dealing with it for a long time, and his recidivism has not been violent. There's been no felony recidivism since, I think the early 2000s. And he's
what are you asking? What relief are you seeking from us?
I think that this court should declare that his sentence violates the Eighth Amendment and reverse the decision of the lower court.
I understand that. So the math I believe you've seen, but what would we say? Would you say, assuming we accept your argument, go back and do it again? Would we have to come up with what we think is a reasonable? Assuming we accept your argument that this is not reasonable, what would the events look like? Would we say, just go back, try again, and then we'll see what the past lies, or would we say, sentence no more than X years? I'm asking about what kind of relief are you specifically seeking, and if there's an X in there, what do you think the X should be? If we say, this sentence is not reasonable, but some lesser sentence would be the upper bound of reasonable, what would that be?
That is a very difficult question to answer. I don't think there's clarity of guidance. I think the best the court could do is say that this particular sentence violates the Eighth Amendment and
try again.
And recently, if say a man violated his crime, no violation.
The sentencing judge, and I got handed like that from federal courts. I think those guys are crazy. I did my best. I think this is reasonable. And they don't think it's reasonable, but they said try again.
I would have to rely on the prior precedent.
So, having come up with what the judge thinks is a reasonable sentence, don't we need to give some guidance as to what we think would be reasonable? I want to know how to carry out that kind of thing that came to me. You did this thing, you thought it was reasonable. Well, you disagree, you don't think we need to say what we think would be a reasonable sentence in which case. If we have to say, don't you think you owe it to us to tell us what you think we should say on behalf of your client? You should tell us what would be the sentence you would consider reasonable.
I think it would have to be determined under state law, given Mr. Tulsi's priors. I haven't calculated that myself, but
the answer is no. I don't
know the exact number of years. I don't know the exact number of years that would be reasonable. I can't give you that now. But I think that it could be determined.
I was just wondering about that. Okay, we'll hear from the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Sokoler from the state. The question here is whether a fair-minded jurist under Section 2254D could find that the sentence was not grossly disproportionate under the very general gross disproportionality principle that was described by the Supreme Court in Lockyer v. Andrade, who said that the only guiding principle under Section 2254D is that a gross disproportionality principle is applicable to sentences for terms of years, and that its precise contours are unclear.
The offense in question is almost a regulatory offense. It's a failure to register. It's not anything that in the real world causes harm. It doesn't robbery or drug abuse or molestation or anything else. It's failure to go and fill out the government form.
Yes, he did. I have two responses to that. One is that it goes to a more important state goal, which is to keep track of sex offenders. And if defendants are routinely failing to renew their annual registrations,
that's true for all regulatory offenses. You know, they always serve an important government purpose. But you will agree with me that in the great scheme of things, it is failure to register. So that violation is in its nature less bad than playing a gun and pointing at somebody or hitting somebody on the head or engaging in child abuse. There's a long list of things that people can do to each other that seem to be inherently worse than failure to register, important as registration may be.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but when we look at the nature of the offense here, as the California Supreme Court said in Coley, and as this court did in the previous Gonzalez case, we look not just at the offense in isolation. Yes, it was extremely easy to understand, and that's why I
guess that's a good place for you to say yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Very well done.
It was an exceptionally well-written opinion. I think that I think I came to the core of my argument by pointing out, as I did in the brief, in what ways this case is distinguishable from Gonzalez. The court got at some of those distinctions during the argument with my opposing counsel. First of all, Mr. Holsey's record was much worse than Mr. Gonzalez's record. We have 4 prior felony convictions, 6 misdemeanors, and 9 probation violations, one of which was one of those misdemeanors.
A question about that. So the trial court here finds that he is a recidivist, and for purposes of sort of the question of recidivism, do we take into account for whole violations as opposed to convictions?
No, I think I would make a slight definitional difference. I think when we're talking about recidivism, and I've never briefed it, we haven't briefed the exact definition. I think that parole violations are part of the overall picture of ability to follow the law that's important in a case like this,
because if we're only going to look at convictions, then his last conviction, as far as I can tell, was in 2002, that was for failure to register.
Then we have
to go back 8 years earlier to 1994. That's his conviction for annoying.
That's correct, Your Honor. And he was that was his second failure to register by the conviction, by the way. He was sentenced to 5 years for it, but his term didn't expire until 2009 because it was on the sentence for that conviction that he had 5 separate parole violations, including one that he committed the day after being released. So this case, the length of time between his most previous conviction and the instant conviction does not mitigate his culpability because he was in and out of prison for almost all of that time, except for,
you know, do we know what the parole violations are for? I know the suggestion in your brief was that they were for alcohol and drug. That's what Ms. Olson's count of those did, but we don't get a lot of detail as to what they're for, and some of them are very quick. You should point out one of them is the day after he's released. But right back.
Right. If we're talking about those five since the last conviction, one of those was for disorderly conduct under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and the record doesn't show what the other ones were for. In terms of the previous five parole violations, I recall that one of them was for the misdemeanor, that ended up being a misdemeanor conviction as well, and this was where he went up to a 10-year-old boy and lowered his pants and said, I'm going to make you suck my penis like an ice cream cone the way I did to the other kids.
But he gets a misdemeanor conviction for...
The way I understand the record is his parole was revoked for that one, and he got a misdemeanor violation. So that is one of the nine.
He was acquitted of a felony charge in that case.
I don't recall it.
That's the 1994.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe that's correct. I believe he was acquitted of the felony charge.
I mean, there's no doubt that this is not a law-abiding guy. He's done some very despicable things. But as I think Judge Biden's questions have pointed out, a lot of that stuff has to do with failure to register, failure to abide by conditions of parole. And, you know, I think all of us have self-conscious of the issues. And some of the cases like that, you have to sort of see as somebody who just can't keep his nose clean, just can't show up for supervised release, you know, can't talk his probation officer, parole officer, probation officer, whatever. But that is, to me, different in kind than somebody who goes out and does crimes in the real world. And, you know, the incident you mentioned, and there are some incidents in his past where he has done the real stuff in the real world. It's nasty. But they are, as I think Judge Curry's question pointed out, they are a long time ago. Most of what's happened, most of what his record consists of recently, is just not complying with the requirements of registration or probation. So I'm having trouble seeing why that's really such bad stuff as deserves such a brutal sentence.
Your Honor, I think it's all part of the same picture with Mr. Holsey. It's part of an all-around contempt for following the rule of law. This was an intentional violation here, as the district court found, which contrasts with the violations in Carmody and Gonzalez. And it's significant that he had two prior violations for failure to follow the registration statute, including the most recent felony, what had been a felony violation of it, for which he had been sentenced to 5 years. So if anyone should have been following this rule, he should have. His many parole violations figure into that, and I would also look at his reaction after the misdemeanor conviction for those words he uttered to the 10-year-old child about orally copulating him when he said to the parole department, this is bullshit, you can't do anything to me. This is all part of a larger pattern of contempt for following the rule of law. And I think that this particular violation fits into that, and it really affects the character of this violation, and that's why we have to do, as Gonzalez and his colleague said, look at the overall picture. And getting back to one point about parole violations, I don't know that parole violations count technically in the definition of recidivism, but they cannot be considered in evaluating an Eighth Amendment disproportionality claim. They were specifically mentioned, for instance, by the Supreme Court in the Ewing versus California case, which referred to Mr. Ewing's felony violations and misdemeanor violations and crimes committed while on parole. To sum up, there are four important aspects that differentiate this case from Gonzalez. One is his record. Second is the fact that his record consists of two prior convictions for violating this law. Third is the deliberate nature of his violation as compared with the violations in Carmody and Clough and Gonzalez, which were merely negligent oversights. And second and third, rather fourth, which I explained in detail in the brief, is the change in the understanding of the nature of this crime, which was explained by the California Supreme Court in Coley, subsequent to this court's Gonzalez decision, when the court explained that in evaluating the seriousness of this particular offense and the failure to annually renew, they evaluate the overall circumstances, including whether it was a deliberate violation and including the defendant's prior record.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Your Honor's time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, regarding counsel's comment that the violation in this case was intentional, that is not in the state court record. That comes from the district court judge's finding, which is not what's under review and under AEDPA. As for contempt for the law, as I mentioned,
I'm sorry.
Counsel mentioned that Mr. Reyes.
I got the part where you said it's based on district court's finding, but I didn't understand what you said follows from that. Don't we owe the district court as much deference as the Superior Court?
I think that what the court, I'm talking about the review of this last state court decision, not containing the facts.
There's no finding on that, and then the district judge makes a finding. Don't we take that finding as equivalent to what the state court didn't find?
I think there is deference there, Your Honor. I think there is some deference, but I just wanted to point out for the state court record, it's been reviewed by the trial court and the court of appeal, and there was no finding. In fact, the courts recognized that this violation can occur negligently, and that's an oddity in the law that someone can be convicted and receive this harsh sentence for just a negligent failure to register, which is bizarre.
But you have an interesting case if there were no finding in the state court, and then the district judge found this was a negligent or accidental or inadvertent violation. Then we have a tough case, I think. But in this case, the district judge, the federal district judge, fills in the finding that the state court didn't make. So, makes it.
I think it's just an unsupported finding. That's my point. Is that it's the judge did find that. I agree.
He says I'm waiting to gather a minor. I don't know why I'm waiting to gather a minor. Isn't actually an admission of intentionality. It's sort of like saying I know I'm supposed to pay my taxes, file a tax return, but I waited for the IRS to send me a reminder. You know, it doesn't mean it's not intentional. It just sounds like he was able to thought he could get away with it until he got a reminder, but he's not entitled to a reminder.
That's true.
And if he had said I forgot or I believe it or not. But seeing I was waiting for a reminder is almost an admission of intentionality, isn't it?
If you view it that way, I can concede that it
could be. Well, just describe it then. Could be viewed a different way.
Well,
how can you wait for something how can you inadvertently be waiting for something?
It's difficult. That issue is difficult because it wasn't addressed. There was the defense presented no evidence of trial on that issue, so it's hard to reconstruct how it could work in the defense's favor. But once again, Mr. Holsey has a long history of mental problems. In fact, I recall on the record he was diagnosed as psychotic at one point. that should have been explored, but it's not a good excuse to say that when I was waiting for someone to remind me to do this, he'd done it before. However, it's still, even if that violation is considered to be intentional, it's still not the kind that implicates all the public safety concerns of the three strikes law. He's not evading police. He's not giving incorrect information, false IDs, not hiding from them. He's telling the police where they contacted where I live at my registered address, and that's where they arrest him. So counsel's argument, I think, gets into a point where Mr. Holsey's being basically punished for his recidivism, which Carmody talked a lot about. They said that violates the Eighth Amendment. When you're just punishing him, looking at the awful record of his past, that violates the Eighth Amendment, particularly where the trigger defense that triggers that consideration is one that's just a technical harm